Don't know if you remember the 1980s, but there was a movie called They Live, and it was about a guy, a construction worker, who stumbled upon some special sunglasses that when he put them on, he saw people for who they really were and realized that, I know this sounds cheesy, but there were aliens living among us in disguise as human beings. So we have beautiful women and well-groomed men who, when the sunglasses were put on, appeared grotesque. They were trusted in society, and yet they were alien monsters. There's subliminal propaganda everywhere on the billboards and the buildings telling people how to live and what to do and so on. And the special effects were super cheesy too. But that's not my point here. My point here, on a serious note, is what if we had special sunglasses that would allow us to see people for who they really were? What if we use those sunglasses on this congregation? What if we use those sunglasses on people that we know and trusted? What if we looked in the mirror and looked at ourselves with those special sunglasses? We may not like what we see. People may not tell you the truth about themselves. They may be projecting an image that they want you to believe but isn't true. Your own reflection may betray who you are or who you want to be. On the other hand, the glasses may confirm what you do project, that you are faithful, that you are trustworthy, and that you are an active servant of Jesus Christ. On the most serious point, Jesus doesn't need sunglasses to know who you are. He has what's called divine omniscience, which is a fancy word or phrase that means he knows everything. Anything that can be known or is to know, he knows it. So anything that's going on in your head, even right now, he knows that. He knows every thought. He even knows why you're thinking it. He knows you intimately and accurately and completely. And he peers into your soul and mind daily and knows our private thoughts and our secrets, everything that others cannot see, or maybe even things that we wish to hide from them. He knows our loyalties too. He knows when we've been true, and he knows when we betray him. He knows when we're sincere. He knows when we're being insincere. He knows when we're being honest. He also knows when we're fooling ourselves. He knows about all our forbidden appetites, whatever they might be, and when we feed those appetites as well. And the only people that can withstand that kind of scrutiny are men or women of integrity, which I will define shortly. Those who are true to Christ have a high integrity, and those with a high integrity are true to themselves and to everyone else. They speak the truth even to their own hurt. The natural question, of course, at this point is, does that describe you? No hands, please. This isn't confession time. But you need to ask yourself the question there. Will the evidence support that claim? If you say, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'm a person of integrity. Well, where is the evidence for that? I'm not saying there isn't any, but I'm saying there needs to be some. And if there is not evidence, or if you are not a person of integrity, then why not? And what are you going to do about it? And when are you going to do it? These are good questions to ask ourselves as we go into our lesson on integrity. When we think about integrity, really we're talking about wholeness or soundness or completeness. The word actually has the same root base as we get the word integer, which of course you all remember from math days as being a whole number. Not a partial number, a fraction, or a percentage. It's a whole number. And so it implies truthfulness and honesty with regard to the thing or the person being examined. The King James Version sometimes translates the word integrity into upright. In other words, just thinking about a person who's not walking around with his head bowed down or shoulder stooped because of guilt or shame, or he's not falling to the ground because he's condemned. The implication there is someone who can stand upright and proud, not proud in himself, but proud in God's having called him. And he can stand upright before God in innocence and blamelessness. In Job chapter 2 and verse 3, God even called Job a man who was blameless and upright, who fears God and holds fast to his integrity. In other words, here's a man who stands innocent. Despite all the temptations and the trials and the adversity that he'd already experienced there. In Psalm chapter 7 and verse 8, the psalmist says, "Vindicate me before my enemies, O Lord, according to my righteousness and my integrity that is in me." In other words, God, because you can see into my soul, you know who I am, you know that I'm upright, you know that I'm just, you know that I have integrity, I stand upright before you, and I allow you to judge me in that way, to see everything about me. You know that I'm innocent and blameless. And so when we talk about a man of integrity, we're really talking about a man whose heart is complete and not divided. It is united, not separated. It's not divided or torn in loyalties. We're really talking about a person who doesn't trust in two opposite things at the same time. In Matthew chapter 6, 24, Jesus says, "No one can serve two masters, certainly not equally and certainly not successfully." People try this all the time, but Jesus says you can't do it. You're going to love the one more than the other. You're going to hold to the one more than the other. That's always the way it's going to be. And so you can't serve God with a divided heart. You can't come to God with part of your heart saying, "I'm all in, God," and the other part of your heart saying, "Except for this thing over here, or this lifestyle, or this behavior, or this sinful activity, or whatever it is over here that I want to cling to." God will not accept that. Or whether it's just another person or another way of life that is contrary to God's will that you want to cling to. Doesn't have to be something evil in itself. It's just something that you're putting on par with God. God says there is no parity with me. There is nothing on par with me. And so for you to put something on par with me brings me down to it or brings it up to me. And neither one of those is justifiable. God has no equal. And so we must worship him and serve him without equal, with a united and not divided heart. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, or chapter 3 rather, in verse 2, Paul talks about one of the qualifications, if you will, of a candidate for an elder is that he must be a husband of one wife. And a lot of people think that that is a technical qualification about his marital status. I don't see that at all myself. Although, yes, he needs to be married to one woman, I get that. But really it's talking about loyalty. In the Greek, it's worded a one-woman man. That husband of one wife, a one-woman man. His loyalty is to his wife and to her only. He doesn't have his wife and then, you know, someone else on the side or someone else in the wings or someone else he's got his eye on. There is one woman in his life. He is a one-woman man. Well, if you think about it, as Christians, we are to be a one-Lord believer. We don't have, one Lord in our life, but then other lords in the wings, or other lords that we got our eye on, or other lords that we serve every now and then. We need to be a one Lord believer, because that's the projection then of a united heart rather than a divided heart. Now, James, on the other hand, talks about a man who prays to God but doesn't believe in prayer. And he says that man has got a divided heart. He uses the word or the phrase a double-minded man. He actually invented a word to make that phrase. We'll talk about that in our James class. But the idea of a double-minded man here is that a man who is torn in his loyalties. On one hand, he says, "Hey, God, I believe in you, and I believe in prayer, and I believe in prayer to you," and so on. On the other hand, he says, "But I don't really believe that this prayer is going to do anything. I'm asking you for wisdom, God, but I don't think you're really going to, give me wisdom. I don't think you're going to do your part to, honor what you said you would do." Double-minded man. And James goes on to say that man is unstable and is not going to be successful spiritually. He has no integrity. He is dishonest and he is untrustworthy. Now, you might look at him and think, he's praying. Yes, but he's praying with a divided heart, which is the problem right there. We need to make this more personal, of course, and less less generic. We need to put on the glasses of the gospel and look into the mirror and ask ourselves, what do we see? 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5 tells us that, to examine ourselves, to test ourselves. and see whether or not we are in the faith. And that's a great thing to do, not just, you know, at times of struggles or trials, but really on a regular basis. You saw the quote here for the Lord's Supper that we put up on the screen, and it says that every time we take the Lord's Supper, what are we supposed to do beforehand? We are to examine ourselves. So this is not a once-a-year examination. This is a weekly examination, or at least a regular examination. So we're examining ourselves not just because someone prompts us to do so, but as a regular habit, make sure you are who you say you really are. So when you test yourself, like we do before the Lord's Supper, you're measuring yourself not to your own standard, but to God's standard. You're saying, God, I allow your word to examine me and to expose in me not only my strengths, but also my weaknesses. Not only my areas where I'm telling the truth, but even areas where I'm fudging a little bit, or, you know, maybe making things up, or just all outlying. I'm allowing you to do that. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself, Paul says. And there are a lot of Christians who think themselves to be something when they are nothing. And I hate to say that because, you know, these are my Christian brethren when I say that. And I'm speaking broadly about in the brotherhood. But they may escape detection from someone else, but God sees everything. This is a time when we should be using a special amount of self-reflection as we look upon ourselves in time for the new year or the year to come. I mean, we just entered into a new year here. This is only the, second Sunday of the new year. We should be really looking at ourselves and saying, where am I at? Who am I? What have I been doing? What could I do better? And when am I going to do it? And so on. These are things that we should ask ourselves. And we should look at resolutions as not a bad thing. I know a lot of times you look at resolutions and you say, I want to, a lot of things, diet better and exercise more and, you know, be nicer, or whatever it is. You've got these things. And those are good things. There's nothing wrong with any of them. And even in a spiritual realm, I'm going to read my Bible more. I'm going to pray more. I'm going to, reach out to people more and be in more better communication with my brethren. Those are great things. Unfortunately, they're also things that are easily broken. And the reason they're easily broken, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out why. First of all, they may be running counter to what we have so ingrained ourselves to do in the first place. So it's hard to make new habits. Old habits prevail. Secondly, there are usually harder things than what we're doing right now. So it's that path of more resistance rather than the path of least resistance. Okay? And third things is because we think that by breaking them, there's no harm done. And that's what I want to speak to right now. When you break a resolution, even if it's not just a New Year's resolution, when you break a resolution, you're not being true to yourself. It would be better that you not make resolutions than to make a resolution and break it. You're not being true to yourself, but you're also not being true to Jesus Christ because he owns you. If you are a Christian, you are in Christ, he owns you, he's purchased you with his blood, and therefore lying to yourself is lying to him. Now you didn't think about that as breaking a resolution is like lying, but it really is, because you promised to do something and then now you're not doing it. Now, I'm just as guilty of this in the past as anyone else. But sometimes we like to downplay the severity of what's really going on. It's like, yeah, I had a New Year's resolution, but I broke it, and, everyone does that. And we kind of pass that off in a very cavalier, casual way. And that's not how we should be looking at that at all. We should be very disappointed with ourselves and do something to rectify that. And I'm saying that because what we did, we just lied. We just said, I'm going to do this, but now I'm not going to do this. And we promised ourselves something. And so we're not just harming our self-esteem here. We're really making ourselves unfit for the kingdom of God. You think about that man that Jesus talked to, or several men that he talked to in Luke chapter 9, there at the end of the chapter, verse 57 through 62. And he talks to would-be disciples, as I refer to them. People that say, I'll follow you, but first let me, I need to go back home and I need to bury my father and, of course I've got to take care of other things first. And Jesus says, very bluntly at the end of that, he says, no one who putting his hand to the plow and then turning back is fit for the kingdom. He's referencing an agricultural thing where you put your hand to the plow and you keep your eyes forward and not looking back, because then the plow goes with you, right? Anyone who's been in driver's ed knows that. So you understand the concept. It's pretty easy to see that. But the point here we're making is Jesus talks about being unfit. He doesn't just say it will be harder or you're going to struggle more. He says you're unfit. And that bothers me. Bothers me that he said that, because it's so easy to be unfit. And that's what we want to avoid. When we compromise between what God says and what we say or what the world says, we're promising two different things to two different masters. We're trying to serve two masters, even though Jesus says you can't do it. But we're trying anyway. And furthermore, I use me here, but I'll turn it around and use you. Why should I trust you if you're breaking promises to yourself? And if you're okay with that, why should I trust any Christian who is not being honest with himself and is not being faithful to what he says? You shouldn't trust me if I'm doing that, and I shouldn't trust you if you're doing that. Why should I listen to you if what I see in you is chronically inconsistent to everything you keep telling me? If you keep telling me you're a faithful person, you're a faithful Christian, and you're all in for God, and you're devout, and you're prayerful, and you're just this model Christian, but I see the opposite in your life, why should I believe you? You shouldn't believe me if I'm doing that. So, in order to be faithful, we need to first of all be faithful to ourselves, faithful to what we have promised. Because if we can't even get that right, we're not fit for the kingdom. We're not fit elsewhere. So this is not a minor problem I'm talking about here. This is a major problem. Spiritual heart disease is the number one killer among Christians. We're talking about heart disease, a heart problem. The good news is it's completely curable. The bad news is most people either don't recognize it until it's too late, or don't want the cure. Sad to say. No one will seek a cure who does not admit, first of all, that he has a problem. There are many Christians who live double lives, and they've been doing so for so long, they don't even see the problem anymore. They're jaded to it. They're callous to it. They've just been going down this path for so many years, and they think they're doing right, and they've got it in their head that they're doing right, but they don't measure themselves up to the standard. They just measure themselves up to themselves or how they've always been doing things, and they think that everything's okay. But if you were to allow that light to shine on them, it would be like putting on the sunglasses and seeing this grotesque being rather than a normal, healthy Christian. Sometimes a loyalty problem is a result of a conflict of desire. There's a war that's going on within. Peter talks about that in 1 Peter 2:11. He talks about fleshly lusts that wage war against the soul. 1 Peter 2:11. I don't think it's in your notes. Write it down if you want. But that war is strong. So what he's talking about, what I'm talking about, same thing. Someone has a strong desire for the Lord, which is a good thing, but they have an equally strong desire to gratify the lusts of the flesh, whatever they are. We often think of sensual and sexual lusts, but it's not limited to those. You can have a lust to lie, or a lust for gambling, or a lust for cheating, or a lust for just doing anything that's wrong. And it comes from the flesh. It's of our human carnal nature. So when you have a strong desire for God and then this strong desire for the flesh, that creates a conflict. And that conflict will resolve itself ultimately. And it will resolve itself by whatever one you feed the most, in essence, is going to dominate over the other. But they're not both going to consistently remain. Other times, a loyalty issue is out of frustration, because we put a great deal of time and effort into being loyal in the past, but we didn't see the payoff. Maybe it's because we still have struggles, we still have hardships, we still have problems, sometimes for years, sometimes for decades, we can't seem to shake that. Or maybe the payoff we thought would be in the visible fruits. We thought we'd see more people that would be converted because of our effort. I have felt this way before. I'll be honest. Well, I thought that, you know, by all the efforts that I put forth as a preacher, I thought that there might be more visible results of that. It's frustrating to not see that. And so taking that frustration to the next level means that now I'm disappointed in what I'm doing, and maybe I'm disappointed in Christ himself. In Job chapter 2 and verse 9, Job's wife, after he suffered so much, she says, "Do you still hold fast your integrity?" She goes on to say, "Curse God and die." And what she's really saying is, you have served God and been faithful for all these years. I know you to be a man of integrity, and this is the thanks that you get from God? This is what he gives you? Curse God before he destroys you. At least get your dig in before he takes you out. It's really what she's saying. Tell God what you think of him before that. Of course, Job comes back and says that she's a foolish woman for saying that. And he goes on to say, "We accepted prosperity. Shall we not accept adversity?" But that's a lesson on Job rather than a lesson on what we're talking about. And you might think of Judas himself, Judas Iscariot, who is possibly frustrated with Jesus' ministry of all things, because there's good evidence to say that he probably got into discipleship, so to speak, because he saw some kind of profit there, financial profit. If Jesus is going to be king, then the best place to be is in the king's inner circle so that you can get some kind of financial reward from that. And when he saw that things were not going well for Jesus, he decided to take matters into his own hands and get his own financial reward, 30 pieces of silver. We all know how that turned out, not well. My point, though, is focusing on the frustration that he might have had that drove him to do that. Benedict Arnold, in history, began as a great military leader for the United States in the Revolutionary War. And yet he saw other men promoted ahead of him. He had incurred a huge amount of debt in the process, and thus he was very disillusioned, and he defected to the British. And that's why we call a man who defects to the other side a traitor. We call him a Benedict Arnold today because of what he did. The point here is discouragement, disappointment, disillusionment, these can all feed the wrong loyalty and cause us to be what used to be a good Christian but now is someone who betrays our commitment and supports the opposing master. We become traitors. The sad part of all this, not to mention what the destruction that's been done, but the sad part is Satan gladly welcomes traitors into his camp. Sometimes a loyalty problem is due to peer pressure. It is very hard to strive against the current of popular opinion, today more than ever, in my opinion. And the reason why I think it's stronger is because we have so much out there that is available at our fingertips. We have a lot of people talking, and unfortunately, even the smallest, most ridiculous, most insane voices get heard by everybody. And so there's a lot of this going on in the giant echo chamber of social media and everything else. 1 Kings chapter 18, 21, we have Jehovah and Baal pitted against each other in the case of Elijah standing for Jehovah and the 450 prophets of Baal. And Elijah is challenging them to call upon their God, Baal, to act and show himself and prove himself. And of course, he can't do that. And so Elijah says, "How long will you," meaning all of Israel, "hesitate between two opinions? How long are you going to dance this dance here? You're dancing into a dance with two partners, and you can't do that for it. How long are you going to do this?" And sometimes we also hesitate because someone asks us to do something against our conscience or against our better judgment, against our own will, and we find ourselves, instead of just immediately saying, "Nope, not going to do that," we find ourselves hesitating and then deliberating. We find ourselves saying in our head, "I know better, but am I willing to do this thing because these people are asking me to do this and I want to identify with them, I want them to approve of me?" So sometimes we are willing to sacrifice or compromise our integrity because we're pressured to do so. And it eats away at our integrity every time we do so. So there's this conversation that goes on in our head, and it boils down to this. Am I going to be true to Christ, or can I do this thing that I know opposes him and still justify or rationalize it myself to be a person of integrity and honesty? If I were watching you, and I saw you compromise and give in, what would I say about that? More importantly, what would Jesus say about that if he saw you doing that? He wouldn't call you a man of integrity or a woman of integrity. He'd call you a traitor, because that's what traitors do. The compromise of loyalty always stems from a divided faith and a sacrificed integrity. We know the right thing to do, but we simply will not do it. And as we discussed in our class in James this morning, James chapter 4, verse 17 says, whenever we do that, it is sin. And in the end, it really doesn't matter what the reason for it was. Doesn't matter why we did it. What matters is how we handled it. Doesn't matter why you sinned in that case. It matters that you did sin. You just didn't handle that rightly. Then we come to Psalm 15, which was read for us here. And we have this really grand picture of a person with great integrity. Who may abide in your tent? Really, the tent referring to the tabernacle, the holy place of God. Who may live there, so to speak? And the psalmist says, he who walks with integrity, works righteousness, speaks truth in his heart. This is what we should be. This is who we should be. These are the characteristics that we should have or be pursuing aggressively in our own lives. These are people who, as he goes on to say, don't slander, don't do evil, don't take up reproach against a friend, don't speak evil against someone, in other words. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised. In other words, an ungodly person is recognized for his ungodliness, but honors those who fear the Lord, swears to his own hurt, and does not change. If he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. Makes a promise, he's going to hold it up, even if it's to his own hurt. Doesn't charge money at interest because he's glad to be giving money to someone who is in need of it. Doesn't take a bribe. He who does these things will not be shaken. And we just looked at that word shaken last week, actually. If you recall, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, Paul says that, that we are to be immovable and abounding and so on. That word immovable in our faith means to be not shaken, even when tested and tried. 2 Peter 1, verse 5 talks about moral excellence. Add to your faith moral excellence, or supply your faith with moral excellence. And that has to do with doing the right thing simply because it's right. Doesn't matter what the cost is, doesn't matter the consequence, doesn't matter where it leads. You know the right thing to do, and you're going to do it, and that is morally excellent. We just talked about morality in class this morning. Morality is consistent with the nature of God. Morally excellent living is a lifestyle that is consistent with God's nature. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, it says, for God has not given us a spirit of timidity or fearfulness or cowardice, but of power and love and discipline. So we do not overcome the world by coming to church and singing songs and taking the Lord's Supper. Rather, Paul says to Timothy, we overcome the world by trusting in the power that God provides, in the love that he has for us, which, by the way, never betrays us, and in the discipline or the stability that we gain from Christ and his word. That's what he's talking about here. Power, love, discipline. That's how you stabilize someone. That's how Christians are to be stabilized. That's how Christians become people of integrity rather than just churchgoers, because not all churchgoers are people of integrity. But you might say that all people of integrity will be churchgoers if you think about that. Many are called, few are chosen. We're told that several times. That means the gospel is available to all, but only those who have spiritual integrity, those who are one Lord believers, will be among those who are chosen in the end. So you should be looking at yourself right now and saying, is that me? Will I be in that group? Does that identify who I am? Does that describe my character? Or simply, how does a person develop and maintain integrity beyond what we said already? Anyone can do this, by the way, but it does take a conscious and deliberate effort. You're not going to stumble into integrity. It's not going to just happen because you went to church for, 10 years and now you're vested with integrity, like being vested for retirement. This doesn't happen that way. It's something you actually have to know what you're aiming for. It's objective in nature, and then you're striving to go to it. First of all, you must not rationalize or justify wrong behavior, but at the same time, you have to learn and pursue right behavior. And our society right now is really struggling with this whole thing of right and wrong and good and evil, which direction to go and which direction not to go. We're really struggling with this. And the reason why we're struggling with it so bad is because no one wants to admit what the real source of right behavior and right thinking is, and that would be God. We are a society who is trying to etch God out of the picture and still come up with a plan that basically follows God's pattern. And it's just never going to happen. So the world wants to neutralize truth, make it ambiguous, so that everyone can justify living as they want to live, however twisted or deviant it might be, and no one is offended. Absolute truth, after all, is offensive, oppressive, and a killjoy. Right? I mean, that's how people think right now. We don't need truth. What we really need is my truth, or you can have your truth as long as nobody gets hurt, right? And nobody realizes that everyone's getting hurt in the process. We are declining as a society by that way of thinking. And everyone in that society gets hurt. Everyone in a society that is in decline is going to feel the pain of that decline. Think about what Isaiah says, and keep in mind, this was written about 700 years before Christ, so the problem is not a new problem, is what I'm getting at. God says through Isaiah, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight." Doesn't that describe exactly where we are today as a society? Unfortunately, it also describes how some Christians are becoming in the church, losing their sight of their moral compass, losing sight of what is right, and drifting away from that. By the way, the word woe here doesn't mean just sad or disappointed. It means a divine curse is leveled against those people. Woe in this context is equivalent to cursed are those people. So we have what God hates, and that is twisting everything around and perverting the truth that he's given us. What we are supposed to do as people of integrity, if that's what we are to love what God loves, and we are also to hate what God hates. Integrity has no in-between there. There is no gray area when it comes to morality. There is no compromise. You can't merely abstain from evil. You need to have a strong hatred and disgust and aversion to evil. But you have to have the opposite of that for what is right, a strong desire, a great zeal, and a passion to do what is right. Not one or the other, but both. We also have to have a conviction of the truth, and we mean God's truth, of course, not your truth or my truth or our collective truth. Just because we come to a consensus doesn't mean we are right. It just means that we all agreed on whatever we decided. We can be very wrong in that agreement. So we're not talking about having a conviction of your own personal conviction. By the way, a word conviction means to have a belief that is so strong that it has to be acted upon. It demands that you act upon it. Not just a belief, but it's a compelling belief. So the belief here has to be equal to what God says and not what you say or what you choose to believe. There are many Christians who are fond of saying, I've got my convictions, I'm going to stand by them, and then they passionately defend their convictions. The problem with that is that's what they are. They're their convictions that they came up with and are not based upon what God said. Nothing wrong with having your convictions, as long as your convictions are squarely based upon what is true. And not just what you came up with on your own or what you've been doing for years and years. Imagine a court. You're in a court of law. You've been accused of something, and you've gone through the process, and the court reaches a verdict about you, and the court says, your jury of peers says, that you are innocent. And then the bailiff comes, puts handcuffs on you, and starts leading you off to prison. And you're looking at the judge and say, but wait a minute, what about the decision of the court? And the judge says, I don't pay attention to that. I think you're guilty, so we're going to just deal with it that way. Well, what's the purpose of law in that case? Or what's the purpose of the court system? Or what's the purpose of justice or being proven innocent if it comes down to a person's own say-so? That's exactly what I'm saying here in my illustration. What's the purpose of God's law and the verdict that is reached in God's law and the purpose of the trial, the examination, if we all get to excuse ourselves anyway? Then we might as well just pitch this out the window because it has no bearing on us anymore. When Christians have reached a verdict or a decision or a conviction, this is what it should be. And that is that God's way is right, and our way, no matter what it is, no matter what we came up with on our own, is wrong. The only way that this all works is when your way is right, is when your way is exactly what God's way is. It is completely parallel to what God's way is. So God's way is right, ours is wrong. Even though we know that, doesn't mean that we all live by that, though. And this is the problem that we're talking about. Many people violate or betray their own belief system. And this is no different than a judge who disregards the decision of the court and just does what he wants. So integrity is all about, I know what is right and I am willing to live accordingly. In fact, not just willing, but I am going to live accordingly, even to my own hurt. This is what finds favor with God, but it also makes you stronger the more that you practice it. It makes you stronger in your faith and in your conviction. Because now you have an invested interest in what you are doing. The third thing here can be summed up in 1 Peter 3:15, where it says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you, to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. We tend to focus in Bible studies on the always being ready part, and that's fine. That's true too. But the first thing is first, sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. I would propose to you that if you are not sanctifying Christ as Lord in your heart, the only Lord, and you are one Lord believer, then the ready defense part all falls to pieces because you are not fit to represent the gospel to anybody because you don't really honor it yourself. So there has to be yourself that is all on board up front in order for the rest of it to work. And in this case, there's no room for half-hearted allegiances. You have to know who your Lord is in order to sanctify him as Lord in your heart, and you have to be true to him. Now, here's the other thing. This isn't all happening in a vacuum, you know, like you have nothing else going on in your life, or you're not being tempted by anyone else. The fact is, Satan wants to be your Lord, and he tempts you all the time. And he pressures you, and he intimidates you. Basically, Satan is always saying, bow to me, bow to me, bow to me. And when we compromise our faith, or we indulge in our selfishness, or we give in to sin, we are bowing to Satan rather than Christ. So think about what's happening here. On one hand, usually on Sunday mornings, we're saying, Jesus, it's all about you, and I'm all in, and I'm faithful, and I'm with you. And then Satan's over here, bow to me. And then we, like, later in the week, we do this sort of thing. We turn around and we bow to Satan. Double-minded man. Unstable in all his ways. He should not expect that he should receive anything from the Lord because of his duplicity, his double-mindedness. That is not a person of integrity. So now we know. And now we know what we need to do in order to be that person of integrity. Before we can serve as disciples or preachers or deacons or elders, Jesus has to be made holy in our heart. Not in someone else's heart or not in our heart collectively, you know, to the generic we editorial Christian perspective, but in your heart. And in the process of making him holy to us, then we are made holy to God. There's our faith in action. And how does God always respond to genuine faith? With godly grace, divine grace. And that's what makes it all work. What about you? Who is your Lord? Who is the Lord of your heart? I know the right answer here, and so do you. Maybe you're saying it in your mind. I understand what the right answer is, but that's not what I'm asking. I'm not asking what is the right answer. I'm asking what is your truthful answer. Would you be described by Christ as a person of integrity? Would this congregation describe you as a person of integrity? If we were to hold you up in front of everyone and said that so-and-so here says that he is a person of integrity, what do you all think? And then have people raise their hand slowly perhaps and say, doesn't have my vote. I know too much. I know that person too well. I know who he really is. Oh, that would hurt, wouldn't it? Now, that doesn't mean those people are right, but maybe they are right. What would your spouse think about you? If you held yourself up as a person of integrity, would your spouse go, absolutely, that person is. He or she is a person of integrity. Or would they go, as much as I want to say so, I honestly cannot support that statement because I know this person too well. And he puts on a good show here, but at home, he's a different person. Or she's a different person. So, what would I say about you? What would you say about me? We should all be willing to put ourselves in the docket there. We should all be willing to put ourselves on trial. So, do you live by the morals and principles that you profess to believe? Or do you expect from everyone else? Do you live by those things? Are you honest with yourself and with others? Do you tell people the truth, or do you just tell them what they want to hear? Now, that point is such a big point. We're spending all of next lesson on that. So I won't say much about it now. Are you the same kind of person here as you are with your friends and your family and at work and in the company of unbelievers? Or do you kind of morph into a different personality and do different things and have a different code of ethics that you would never do here in front of all of us, but you feel comfortable doing with everyone else? Would you take something that didn't belong to you, especially if you could get away with it? Have you taken something that didn't belong to you and thought that you could get away with it? Are you hard and inflexible on your evaluation of other people, but soft and permissible and tolerant when it comes to yourself or people that you care about? In other words, are you very critical in your judgment of others? I can't believe that guy did that. And then your own family member does the same thing, and you're like, well, you know, there's reasons for that. And justify and justify and justify. Or when you do it yourself, you find some way to rationalize that. Is the image that you project consistent with the evidence that you provide? Everyone's projecting an image here. Whether you realize it or not, you're all projecting an image. Now, what I'm asking here is the evidence that you supply over time going to uphold that good image I would hope that you would want to project, or is it going to say something different than what you want to project? What kind of fruit do you reveal over time? Do you want everyone to trust you? And if so, are you trustworthy? Are you worth our trust in you? It's really what that word means. Or do you lie to yourself? And as we said earlier, how can I trust you if I know that you're lying to yourself? Or why should I or anyone believe someone's faithfulness unless they have good reason to say so? There's good evidence to support it. These are tough questions. And I have to tell you, in writing this lesson, it was very uncomfortable because I did not successfully get through all of these questions without some need to work on things here myself. I don't like what I see in myself sometimes. Maybe you don't like what you see in yourself. I'm doing something about what I have struggled with. I'm asking you to do the same for yourself if you see errors and inconsistencies. What if we could all see ourselves exactly as Jesus sees us? Would we be frightened and shocked Or would there be no surprises? In due time, we are all going to stand before Christ, and he will expose us. If you are a person of integrity, you have no worries. If you stand before God now, then standing before him in judgment, it's all the same. You know where you stand. You're in a good spot, so to speak, and all will be well. Integrity is agreement between what we believe and what we do. It's an agreement between what we claim to believe and what we actually do, if I could say it that way, especially when what we believe is true. Now, we are all familiar with Shakespeare, who said, be true to thyself, or to yourself, to thine own self be true, if you want the exact quote. But Christians have or live by a different value system. To Christ be true. Be true to Christ. And when we are true to Christ, everything else follows. Everything else falls into place exactly where it needs to be, when it needs to be, and how it needs to be. We don't have to figure out all the other detail. We just need to be true to Christ and recognize that all of that will make the rest of it work. When we walk in agreement with the Lord, we are always heading in the right direction. Wisdom and understanding come from God, not from ourselves. We know that we can't walk two separate paths and go in the same direction. One path goes in one way, the other path goes in the opposite direction. So you have to find out who it is that you're basing your morality and your ethics on, who it is that you're using for your integrity. If we are in Christ and we have chosen Christ, the world has chosen Satan, we have chosen Christ to be our Lord. Be true to Christ. Be true to him. Remaining true to Christ is difficult and unpopular, but it is the only path to heaven, to our Father, to a glorious life and future. Do you have the courage to walk it and stay on it no matter what? These are the questions that Christ needs to hear answered by you to him. If there is anything that we've said this morning that has pricked your heart or maybe has moved you in some way to do better, which is what I hope, that we should all strive to do better, then think deeply upon what we've said and do something about that. Or if there's some reason why you need to come forward this morning, then do that. This would be your time to do that as we stand and sing the song that Bob has selected for us here.